Good morning. I'm afraid to say, my name is Rhea, and I'm an alcoholic. All right. Woo! Yeah, you got that right. This is the first time I've ever spoken in the morning. I usually go and pray somewhere for a few minutes so I can just remember that it's God's deal, not mine. And so I went up to my room, and there was a plumber in there. So I came back down. I went to the bathroom in the front of the hotel, and about every 15 seconds, there was this... Bzzz. So I left there. You know, that's not going to work. So I went out to the pool, and I'm thinking, nice. And it was too cold. So I went into the hospitality room, and there was nobody there. And I walked away around there just a few minutes, you know, and God said, you can trust me. You can trust me. Yeah. So I said, oh, okay. And so I'm still scared. But I'm from Arkansas. That's where I was born. I hate to say that with the present political condition of the country, but that's the state where the only virgins are girls who can outrun their brothers. I always try to say something good about Arkansas. However, I had a younger brother and I could whip him, so I didn't have a problem there. I did, however, have an uncle and two cousins that I did have some problems with when I was a small child. I carried that with me my whole life. I always believed that was my fault. And frankly, I would have done anything to feel loved as a little kid. Because I didn't. I did not feel loved. And that's just, you know, they say you're supposed to qualify yourself. What you were like, what happened, and what you're like now. So I thought I'd get right to it. Because of what it was like was pretty painful. My family were in the carnival business. I traveled all over the country, everywhere, when I was a little kid. Had a lot of good times, saw a lot of things. And then in the wintertime, I would go back and live with these strange people in Arkansas. For a while. Until I was about in the fifth grade, then they threw me into Catholic schools. Which was another completely diametrically different kind of experience. And they loved me. Yeah, that's the first time I think I ever felt loved. Benedictine nuns. This is a semi-cloistered order. They saw very little of the outside world. And they taught. And I was in the fifth grade when I went there, and I had gone to, I don't know, I had traveled with my folks as some, and I had gone to a different school every week or so for a while. And if you've ever been a new kid at a school, you know how painful that is. Just being the new kid is bad enough. But if you're the new kid once a week and you came in with the carnival, try to think about that one. And so I learned at a very early age to lie really well. And I was good at it. I was very good at it. I would tell them anything to be accepted, you know. I would tell them that I wrestled bears in the afternoon to be accepted. And they used to come out and to see all these wild things I told them I did. And my mother, as my best enabler, would always tell them, well, she's got a headache tonight and she can't do it, or she's sick, or she's something. And so I was ashamed. I was always ashamed because I knew I was a liar. Even then. So I carried that with me. You know, I'm packing my bags, baby. I'm on my way to becoming a great alcoholic. All of these different little things that happen to us. And I believe that inside of me, always there's been this self-knowledge. And I think that God put it there. That I knew what I was. I knew when I was lying. I knew when I was wrong. And I tried my very best during most of my life to hide totally from all this self-knowledge, as I have met a lot of alcoholics in the same shape. We knew inside, but we wouldn't admit it even to ourselves. So I carried all this stuff with me when I went to these Catholic schools, and as I say, they taught me to read. I had never been able to read before. I should have known something was wrong because that was my first addiction. I read every book I could find. I could escape and I could be somebody else and I could go somewhere else and I did not have to be me. And it was wonderful. I remember the first book very clearly that I was really able to comprehend, and it was The Little Prince, about a little kid who was dropped as a baby. And he had a magic carpet, and he could go anywhere and see anything and be anybody. And I loved that story. And I think I lived it. My magic carpet was a little different than his. But I had one later on. Now, I don't know when I first started drinking, but my father was an alcoholic, although I didn't know that, and he didn't either. I'm Irish. He was Catholic, but I didn't know it. Even though I went to Catholic schools, I didn't know my father was Catholic until the funeral. We really communicated a lot. So I went to all these Catholic schools, and I was somewhat confused because in the summertime, by the time I was about 12, as soon as I could make change, I had my own business. And I would be robbing suckers in the summertime and telling you you could get a ring over a hoop that was impossible for you to do, and I could even show you how to do it. And in the wintertime, I was learning how to be a lady. It was a little confusing, you might say. And I had all of these other things going on in the back of my head, all these lies and all this cheating and this sexual abuse, and I never told anybody. I never told anybody about those things. Because if you would just love me, if you would just love me, I would do anything. I grew up, sort of. I got taller. Not much. A little. I've been 5'2 since I was 15, and I kept waiting for something else to happen, but it never did. I don't know when I started to drink. I drank. We always drank. You know, my father always thought it was a good idea if I drank at home. That way I could learn, you know, to handle myself in public. And I remember the first party they took me to. I was about 16. And it was at an American Legion Hall, some dry place in some Indiana or somewhere. And they had beer stacked up against the walls. I'll never forget it. And this was the first time I could legally drink in front of them. And my social drinking career lasted about 45 minutes. I had to be carried out. I mean, from the very first public thing, you know, I mean, I had to be carried out and put in a car. But I loved it because I felt different. I felt at home. I felt tall, beautiful, smart. One time Clancy wrote an ad. You know, Clancy used to be in advertising, and he wrote an ad, and nobody understood the ad but him. It was for vodka, I think. For vodka. And the ad said, boom. Boom. I understand that ad, but they didn't, the normal people, and all, you know, they didn't understand that. But for me, it was boom, baby. Boom. So I went boom a lot for a long time. I started getting married at an early age. After all, there was something wrong, but it wasn't me, right? It was not me. I'm fine. I've always been fine, but you know the definition of fine, don't you? We won't go there. And I started doing other things. I remember I smoked marijuana. I didn't smoke cigarettes, but I smoked marijuana. I discovered marijuana when I was 19. I already discovered booze a long time ago, since I was a little baby, but, you know, I just started piling these things up, and I discovered some other things. And men, I discovered men. Oh, my God, what a distraction. They were wonderful. They were so interesting and different. And, you know, when I was 20 years old, we didn't sleep with everybody. We married them. We took hostages early on, quickly, fast. No mercy at all. I married several of them in a row, and there was something wrong with every single one of them. Every man I've ever known or cared about has been an alcoholic. The only difference between now and then is the one I love now isn't drinking. But always I loved alcoholics. Daddy was an alcoholic. It was good enough for Mama. So I led a very interesting life for the next 15 or 20 years. You know, I married, I didn't marry. I had a couple of children by different fathers, different last names. At least they had one, but you know, you have to be grateful for the good stuff. But after the second child, I got to thinking. I was to a point I knew that I couldn't trust myself. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I didn't know what I was going to do. I might fall in love with anybody at any moment. But I knew I didn't want to have any more children with any further last names. I knew there was something wrong. And I always wondered what it could be. It never occurred to me that it could be what it was. But it occurred to me that it could be a whole lot of other things. I figured it out. It's got to be my parentage. It's a carnival thing. You know, if I ever had an even chance, if you have only had an even break, it's the deal that I got. The cards I was dealt in life. Dear God, look at those rotten cards. You know? Went to all those silly schools, didn't even know how to read till I was 7 or 8 years old, and never had a chance. So I figured, well, it's got to be that. You know, and things would go well for a while. Things would look good. And I would work and this, that, and the other. Well, I didn't really work much, but a little bit. And every time everything failed for me, I would get married. I would get married. I had the same solution. Well, you're not making it on your own. Get married. And I did it over and over again. I lived about 25 years. I lived the same year about 20 times. Now, I didn't get married that many times, but you get the idea. I'm sort of qualifying myself here because it's really important. It's really important. I didn't know what in the world was wrong. What could it be? The world was a very dark place for me. Yeah. I finally married somebody and that, you know, I got a tiger by the tail. I got somebody I couldn't get rid of that I was afraid of, who was violent and mean. And it took me about 7 or 8 years to get rid of him, to get him out of my life. And he told me he would kill me and my dog and my brother, and, you know, I believed him. And he was just like me. We were alcoholics. We were both alcoholics. We were drug addicts. There was a lot of violence. And the person I am today, you know, wonders mightily at that woman. How in the world could that woman have been treated the way that she let herself be treated? How could she have lived in a situation like that and done those things that she did? But the world in which I lived, I believed he loved me. Because he told me he did. And he told me it was because he was jealous. Okay? I believed all those lies. I believed lots of lies. And that's the difference between my life today and my life then. Is I no longer believe a lie. I know the truth. And not only about those kinds of things, but a great many other things that have been brought to my attention by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you very kind people in it who have pointed out the truth to me for the last 15 years. My sobriety date, by the way, is January 1, 1988. About 12 and a half years sobriety. It's almost time for me to get sober here, but I want to give y'all a couple more shots first. You never know what you're going to get with me. Sometimes I'm funny and sometimes I ain't, okay? But anyway, I rocked on. I finally got rid of that guy. And I went home. When all else failed, I always went home to Mama. I mean, they had to all die and burn the house down to get rid of me. You know, everybody had to be gone because I did not know how to function in the world. I never did get out of high school. I quit when I was a senior. I'd gone to about 8 years of Catholic school, and they taught me, you know, the history of the Catholic Church and the history of religion and all this other stuff. And my senior year, I was somewhere in Florida trying to finish in a public school, and they said, well, about April, they said, well, you know, you're not going to graduate because we don't count all those credits for the history of the Catholic Church. And I said, well, I'll show you, right? So I quit. And I went and got a bottle of vodka. And that has been my solution. I mean, that's what I did. So I had that to carry. I've carried that shame. Oh, God, was I ashamed of that. Because I've been told, here's my least favorite word in the dictionary.
Potential. You've got so much potential.
I hate that word. You know, because I never could make it. I mean, I could go 50 yards in any 100-yard race. I was halfway there, baby, for anything. But I never could finish anything. I never could do it. I wanted to do it, dear God. And you talk about not being able to look the world in the eye. I mean, I was so ashamed of all of these things. And I knew that I had so many secrets and I would never be able to share them. I mean, this ugliness of this, you know, I had no childhood. No childhood. Yeah. It was stolen from me. I always felt that. I was really pissed, too. I drank a lot about that. You know, if only it had been different. If only I'd have had a normal parent, you know, and on and on and on. I mean, I was very good at feeling sorry for myself. Anyway, I think I got married again sometime here. I went and got a real estate license. I practiced real estate for a while. I did very well. And then my father got sick with cancer, liver cancer. And I was about 32 at the time, and all bets were off. You know, I was divorced, two children. I had one in Florida and one in New York with their respective fathers. My father, who was the only person, I mean, no matter what I did, no matter what happened, he would fix it. Daddy fixed it all. Daddy was God. Alcohol was God. Daddy was assistant God. Maybe that's better. But he always made sure everything worked out for me. And he got sick. And I had to watch him die. We took him to the MD Anderson and this and that. And I remember at his funeral, I couldn't grieve anything. I was snorting coke and drinking whiskey and smiling and saying, "Welcome, and come and sit down." And I looked very well. You know, I had on a nice outfit. I always, you know, figured it's not how you feel. It's not what you are. It's how you look. If everything looks okay on the outside, it's okay. I can handle it. And I was dead inside. Desolated, lost. My world was gone, just like that. A little while after that, my mother moved back to Arkansas. I was in a little bit of trouble. I bought a mechanical bull. Remember when the mechanical bulls were all the rage? My best friend owned a nightclub, surprise, surprise, on the Gulf Coast, Gulfport, Mississippi. That's where I was living at the time. And we're sitting around snorting a little coke, drinking a little whiskey, going, you know, what can we do that you can do that you don't have to do anything? Because I couldn't do anything. I was incapable of working. And I had some money. I don't know how, but I had some. So we thought about this mechanical bull thing. And we didn't think it all the way through exactly. But within 3 days, I was in Houston at Gilly's buying one of these damn bulls. Within 3 days. I mean, I didn't even know how much the insurance cost. Turned out to be rather high. And I drug it back to the Gulf Coast, and we put it in the middle of his nightclub, and we started bucking. Oh, God, help me. And we bucked a lot. You know, and people broke wrists and this, and I mean, people were flying through the air, all these drunks. I mean, we were having a hell of a time. Insurance was about $1,600 a month. I mean, you have to do a lot of bucking, okay? And my mother was still, she had shows and stuff. My father was dead, but she still had these exhibits. And I forgot to tell you something, though. When I was a child, my father was a very gifted builder. And he built illusions. And we had this show, and it was, it looked like you could go in and you'd walk around this cage, and it would look like you're looking at a table that you can see underneath. And on top of the table is the head of a woman or a girl, and the body is an alligator. All right? And I used to, well, and I used to be the alligator girl. And I mean, I hated him for this. I'd sit in this thing. It's a box, and it's surrounded by mirrors, but it's beautifully done, and so it looks like you're looking under the table. And people would come in and ask me questions. Like,
can you wiggle your tail?
You know, I mean, I loved my father, but I hated his guts. And you'd have to sit in there about 4 hours at a time. And, you know, and they would say out in front,
she walks, she talks, she crawls on her belly like a reptile. Come in and see the alligator girl.
Yeah. So I had that to carry with me for many, many years, the alligator girl. I know it sounds completely insane, doesn't it? Anyway, my mother still had some of these exhibits out on the road, and she had a guy taking them out on the road for her, and he was robbing her blind. Now I'm drinking and drugging and doing, you know, bobbing and weaving and bucking, you know. And my mother called me and said, you know, he's robbing me. And of course I knew him very well. I'd known him for years. So I decided to kidnap him. So I did. I went and got him and invited him over to my house. And I told him he wasn't leaving, you know, and that he needed to figure out how he was going to pay my mother back the money that he owed her. He was afraid of me. I don't know why exactly, but he was. In the middle of this kidnapping, I needed to go to the airport and pick up a friend I had forgotten about. And when I got back from the airport, everybody was in jail. My friends, everybody who was at my house, they were all in jail because this guy had called somebody. He was really afraid and had called somebody, and they'd sent the police, and they'd come to my house, and they'd found this, and they found that, and they found the other, and you know, a gun or something that had been stolen in 1961. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, just stupid stuff. Anyway, I was in trouble. So now, here I am, and I've got this bull in this nightclub bucking. I've got this high profile. I got all these friends, you know, these nightclub people, all this stuff. And my picture comes out in the paper for kidnapping. You know, it was all dropped later, but it was extremely embarrassing. I figured it was time to go to Arkansas. You know, now's a good time to go. Let's go visit the relatives, okay? So I went to Arkansas with my mother. We both went up there. I figured nobody'd think to look for me there. You know how one thing leads to another? They find this, they want to talk to you about it, and they find that, and they know you got some friends, and they want to talk to you about them. And I knew what they wanted, and I wasn't going to do it. Because I had been taught from a very early age, don't tell anybody anything. Nothing. I practiced it. I practiced it. You never call the police. You never call a doctor. You know, if you're going to OD, get in the shower. Either you'll die or you won't. And that was my philosophy, and I lived by it. So I went to Arkansas because I didn't want to talk to these interesting folks who were trying to ring my phone. I got off all these charges. I had no conviction on my record. Cost me every penny I had. I had a friend who had a friend, and the DA went to Florida to Disney World when I came up to trial. So I got nothing but broke. So I went back to Arkansas. Now, what do I do when all else fails? I can't work. I can't think. I have nothing. I look around. I looked around. I found me a very good-looking alcoholic with great shoulders and a job. And I married him. I married him. And my poor mother was still alive at the time. Mother was a diabetic for many years. By the way, you know, there's a lot of that. Diabetics and alcoholic families, or alcoholics and diabetic families, whichever. My mother said, don't do it. Don't marry this guy. In 2 years, he's not going to be able to speak. I said, Mother, you don't understand. When we get married, he is going to stop drinking. You know, of course, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm fine. You know, it's them or circumstance or whatever. Anyway, so I married this guy, and a couple years later, I mean, he had a great job at a paper mill. He'd work 4 days and be off three or whatever. And those days that he was off, he would get drunk 3 times in one day. He would get up in the morning, he would drink, he would drop to the floor. And he'd sleep for a couple hours, and he'd get up and he'd do it again. He did it like 3 times, and it was a remarkable thing. And I figured out that he had a problem. I knew he had a problem. I never heard of AA. You know, I never heard of any of that. You know, I was much too cool for any of that. But it just so happened that his best friend didn't drink. I thought they were sort of odd. He and his wife, they didn't drink. I didn't know they were in AA, but they were. And so I called this guy, and I told him, I said, you know, I don't think I can live this way anymore. I can't do this. And he came over, and I told this husband, I said, look, you know, if you don't do something about yourself, I'm leaving. I mean, that's what I always do, isn't it? I always leave. There's always something wrong with you, and I always leave. So I said, well, you know, if you don't do something about yourself, I'm out of here. So about 3 days later, he says, well, how about if you go to one of these meetings with me? I said, well, you know, hey, if it'll help you, I'll go anywhere. So we started going to these meetings. And so I figured, well, now, in order to help him, I probably shouldn't drink, you know, I mean, you know, just to sort of help him. So we started going. We'd go, and I'd go to the meetings, and I wasn't drinking. And about 30 days later, I didn't know it was 30 days later, but they said it was 30 days later, and they gave me a chip. In Arkansas, they used to give you, at the beginning of the meeting, they would give out the chips. And so they gave me this 30-day chip, and I was like, wow. And about halfway through the meeting, I figured out that you weren't supposed to be smoking dope. So I had to give them their chip back, you know. I mean, I really thought I was doing so well. So I said, well, I think I'll, you know, maybe I'll just not do anything and just see, you know, I mean, let's just see if we can do this. Whoa. The world became a very odd place. I couldn't drive. I couldn't sleep. I sweated. You know, I couldn't think. My whole mind was just a fuzzball. They started having to carry me places. They started taking me. And in Arkansas, if you wanted to go to over a couple meetings a week, you had to go to all these little towns all around. You know, 30 miles over here, go to Monticello, go to there. I lived in dumbass Arkansas. Actually, it's Dumas, but, you know, that's where I was living. Dumbass Arkansas, and that's where I got sober the first time. So we started going to all these meetings, and I'm learning about the big book, and I'm not doing this. And about 3 months later, it was so that I could maybe drive. And they had been taking me to this meeting where there was a treatment center, and I used to go in there in the first 30 or 40 days, you know. And I'd sit there, and I don't know how. I never went to treatment. I don't know how they put up with me. But I'd sit there, and I might get tickled, and I'd laugh through the whole thing. Or I might find something really sad, and I'd cry through the whole thing, sob. You know, and they were just like, keep coming back, honey. Keep coming back. I mean, they were laying odds, 8-5 against, that I would ever make it. I was so sick. I was so, so terribly sick. So I started getting the idea of this big book thing. And we'd go, and, you know, we'd read, and I'd talk, and I have a good memory, and I love to read. So I was pretty good at getting the big book down. But, you know, I didn't need a sponsor. I mean, after all, I'm not that bad. I was going to dance my way to sobriety. So about a year into this, the husband decides he's not an alcoholic. I'm fine. So all these weirdos come back to my house. And I'm like, in the meantime, my daughter and his daughter both graduate from high school, and I was taking them over to enter them into college. And while I was over there, I signed up as a special student. After all, I don't have a high school diploma, right? So we all three went to college at the same time, only I went as a special student to get a GED. I got my GED in the first semester. I'm the only one who finished college in 3 years with a 397. The rest of those clowns dropped out. Oh, God. So, anyway, so I come back home a special student. He didn't like that much. And he's drinking and drugging and running amok and this and that. And I keep saying, look, I can't do this. I'm not going to be able to do this. So I moved out in a little while. And I moved into an apartment like my son was like 13 or 12. Crazy, crazy. Why shouldn't he be? Into an apartment about as big as this podium, on campus housing. And I kept going to school. And after I had been sober about a year and a half, I had sort of figured it out that it was really school. School. School is going to save me. I'm going to do school. And so I started, you know, slowing down, going to meetings. And in December of 1987, I went to Alabama to a funeral with a girlfriend of mine who was not in the program over the Christmas holidays. I didn't have a sponsor. I hadn't worked any steps. Who needs steps? I know what they are. New Year's Eve, sitting in a bar, minding my own business, I raised my little hand and said, I'll have a White Russian. I tried to drink like I had always drank. I must have drank 25 White Russians. And when I woke up the next day, and here's the deal, though. The next day, or a few days after that, for the very first time, I realized I was an alcoholic because of Jim. Remember Jim in the big book? Jim. Jim and me are blood brothers. because the reason I identified so well is the only thought I had is that I wasn't being any too smart. I mean, hell, I'd been to 200 AA meetings, and that's exactly the same thing Jim had after he just got out of the nut house. Remember, Jim? I mean, it was like when that hit me, it was the first time that I truly understood that I'm an alcoholic. Oh, my God, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I mean, I've been to God knows how many meetings, but I mean, it was like, I was like running around. I'm an alcoholic. I was scared to death. That's January 1, 1988. Scared to death. Knew I was going to die. You're going to die. What the hell are you going to do? I lived in this little town in Arkansas, and there wasn't a woman there that had worked the steps. There wasn't anywhere. There wasn't anybody. I was going to everything. I was scared to death. Now, we know that fear is not going to keep you sober. So I went up to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, to Springtime of the Ozarks, which is a wonderful convention. 1,200 alcoholics, dogwoods blooming in the mountains, just a big old thing. The end of the Ozarks is where the convention is, and right across the street's a little motel called the Joy Motel. And that's where I stayed. I was going to everything. I knew something had to be done, but I had no idea what it was. After all those meetings, I did not know. Saturday night, they have a big dance, and they have a speaker downtown, and they take trolley cars and this and that, and so the dance doesn't start to 10, and it's at the end of the Ozarks. About 5 o'clock Saturday afternoon, I go over to change to get ready, because after all, it's not how you feel, baby. It's how you look. I went over to change to get ready for this dance, and I go to the door, and I'm so filled with fear, I'm so afraid, that I cannot open the door. And so I'm like, you know, when all else fails, change clothes. So I did that. It didn't work. It didn't work. Finally, I got on my knees, and I told God, I said, God, I'll go anywhere. I don't know who you are, but I'll do anything. I'll talk to anybody. Right now, I got chills all over my body. I mean, I was working step 3, only I didn't know it. I will do anything. Please help me. I cannot live this way anymore. Something happened. You know what they say in a big book? Sometimes a very great change will take place, unless followed by vigorous action, that it won't stay. But this was this overwhelming feeling. Something changed in my heart. So eventually, about 9:30, I got out of my room and I went across the street, and it was empty, of course. I could have any table in the house because it doesn't start till 10. Everybody's downtown at the speaker. So I got a table and people start coming and friends come and sit at the table and all this. And some guy came over and asked a friend of mine to dance. Answer your phone. And so she danced with him, and then he asked me to dance. And he started talking to me about the healing of the inner child. And I began to weep right there in front of God and everybody and all those 1,500 people and all these happy drunks. Sobbed. And this clown was from St. Louis. And one of those big book Nazis. Just so happened he brought all his work papers with him. You know. So I went out with him and about 3 of his sponsorees, and we talked for about 2 or 3 in the morning. And the next day he met me for breakfast and gave me these worksheets and told me exactly what to do, and sent me on my way back to Monticello, Arkansas, which is where I was living now on the campus. I'd had about 90 days. And he said, this is a resentment list, this is a fear list, this is a sex inventory, and this is what you do. And I was at the place where the teacher appeared. That's where I was. And it didn't take God 24 hours. I mean, it was boom. 3 hours after I worked step 3. There he was. So he flew down from St. Louis about 10 days later, and I worked the steps. I did my resentment list. I did my fear inventory, and I did my sex inventory. One of the interesting things that appeared from this exercise was the pattern of my life. I did not realize that I had a pattern, but I had a pattern. I kept repeating the same things over and over again, expecting different results. But the way it was done and the way it came out of the big book and the way he, this big book Nazi, explained it to me, it was as clear to me as the sunrise. I could see it. It changed everything. On my sex inventory, he told me, you know, it's not who you slept with, it's who you've harmed. Who have you harmed with your sexuality? And I tell my sponsorees today, how have you used your sexuality as a woman to get what you want? Not necessarily sex, mind you, but your sexuality, your femaleness, your womanhood. How have you bartered that away to get what you want? How have you used other people by being a woman? So we have to look at these things very carefully. I did not want to, but I had to. I needed to, so that I could be free of those terrible burdens. And that resentment list, I, you know, after a little while, one kept coming back, and that was my father. He was dead, and I was mad. I felt he had done so much to me. You know, he never could tell me he loved me. He was an alcoholic. He was like me. He couldn't transmit something he didn't have. But I couldn't understand it. So my sponsor told me to write a letter and to tell him all the things that I hated about him and all the things he'd done and all that junk. And then down at the bottom to say all the good things he'd ever done for me, all the kind things, all the wonderful things. And at the end to write down that I forgave him. Well, okay. I don't wanna. So I wrote the letter. And then I stalled around and stalled around. He was buried in Gulfport, Mississippi. And my sponsor kept saying, well, when are you going to go down there? When are you going? Well, finally one day he came by on a Sunday morning and said, get your ass in the car. And he drove me to Gulfport, Mississippi, down to the place where my father was buried, to the cemetery. And it was raining, I'll never forget it, and I had my umbrella, and I'm looking all over this damn cemetery for my father's grave. I didn't even know where it was. I couldn't remember. Finally, I found it, and it's raining. And I'm beginning to read this letter. You know. And I'm beginning to sob. And when I got, you know, and I told him all the things that he'd done to me. And all the disappointments that I had had. And how I felt that he hadn't loved me and never shown me his love. And then I read the part about all the things that he had done. And realized, of course, during this experience, that he had loved me in the way that he could. And when I got to the bottom of that letter and I said, I forgive you, please forgive me, I meant it. It was real to my heart. It had stopped raining somewhere in there, and this rainbow, I mean, you know, this rainbow came across the sky. I mean, it was absolutely God doing once again for me what I cannot do for myself. I didn't know what to do about all the good things that had happened. I kept going to school. I went to graduate school, University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. I figured I was going to go for my PhD, but there were very few MLA jobs out there. I loved to teach. I was a TA there, taught English composition. I mean, here I am, this little drunk with no high school diploma, teaching in college English composition, which, I mean, and I love books. I mean, I'm a book freak. I've been a book freak since I was born. So naturally, I'm an English major. And I kept going to these meetings. And this sponsor kept harassing me now because he wanted to get married. Yeah. So I finally figured out that I wasn't going to accomplish that goal, that it wasn't the thing for me to get the PhD. So I went to Atlanta because we had been seeing each other for a couple of years off and on, like weekends off and on. I went to came to Atlanta, and we got married. I was very grateful to him. You know, I was not in love with him. I was very grateful to him. He introduced me to the God of my understanding. I was so, you know, that's one of the reasons why men shouldn't sponsor women. It gets terribly confusing. You know, it happened at the time, and I'm forever grateful for all that he did for me. And he and I started a company together called Tomahawk Trucks here about 10 years ago. I'm the president of that company, have been since it was put in. I had some money. I had the cash capital for startup. We now have 5 stores in Atlanta. We have one in Atlanta. We have one in Dallas, Texas, Richmond, Virginia, Orlando, Florida, and Kansas City, Missouri. I sold it. We sold it last year to a public company. I'm still the president of that company, although here recently I just backed out of day-to-day operations, gave up the power of running it day-to-day. A very strange sort of a thing, very difficult when you've got some power like that to just say, it's time for me to leave. It's time for me not to do that anymore. We've been divorced for about 4 or 5 years now, and we were still partners. Everything was in my name because he'd had a bankruptcy in his history. I mean, I could have taken him to the cleaners because he was out doing things he shouldn't have been doing. But we had agreed early on that we would be partners. So I gave him half of everything because that's what I was supposed to do. That was the thing to do, you know. Although it wasn't on paper and I owned everything. But anyway, after that, when I continued on. After I married that sponsor and I moved to Atlanta here, I came here, I guess I had about 2.5 years sober. And lived in Buckhead. I used to go to the 11 o'clock meeting at NABBA every day almost. I see a lot of faces here, people that I've seen there over the years. Eventually I had to move down to McDonough because my company's in Conley and it was just way too much for me to drive all that way. So I moved down to McDonough, which is another universe. Totally another universe. a lot of things have happened to me in my sobriety. Dear God, a lot of things. What time is it? I don't want to take up too much here. Over the last years, there's been a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. This company about drove me wild because the partner that I had, who was my ex-husband over the last 3 or 4 years, he's tried to undermine everything I ever did there. I was the boss. He didn't like it. So, he was the executive vice president. I was the president. I owned 51% in the divorce because I said, take it or leave it, bud. Because I knew I was never going to work for him, okay? But he tried to undermine everything I did. So, finally, we had a meeting a few weeks ago, and in this meeting, he said, if I didn't report to you, I'd be a completely different person. I said, really? Now, he's 15 years sober, supposedly. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, well, how would you be different? He said, well, I always feel like you mistreat me. And he said, I wouldn't mistreat people if I were the boss. I would be good to them because I would understand that I need all of them. He never, ever expected me to say, which is what I said, okay, here you go. See you later. It wasn't working the way because I could not get his support and he was always trying to undermine things. So I said, you take it day to day. And I'll do what the company that bought us has wanted me to do all along, eventually, which is be investor relations. So go out and meet with stockbrokers and tell them how smart I am. I can do that. I can do that. So right now I'm sort of on hiatus, for the next 60 days or so. Get to go to the international convention. Get to go to, their Sober Vacations is putting on a boat trip after the international, which is the American Queen that goes down the Mississippi River, the paddle wheeler, Clancy, and everybody, all these California, everybody, all these speakers, that the whole boat's AA, like 400 folks from Minneapolis to St. Louis, about a 6-day cruise. Get to do that. Had a pretty rough week this week. My son got thrown out of his 5th treatment center, I think. He'd been there a couple weeks. And I had sent him to a psychiatrist. He's almost 27. I paid for a psychiatrist, Dr. Ed Smith here in Atlanta, who's a recovered alcoholic and who's very good. And he told me, he said, look, you got 2 choices. If he's willing to go to a long-term treatment center, or either you need to drop him and just let him hit his own bottom, whatever. Either way, that's your choices. Pick one. So yesterday, my husband and I got up at 4:30 in the morning to put him on a plane to Newark to go to Alena Lodge. Anybody familiar with Alena Lodge? It's a tough customer. Long-term residential. They work with the reluctant to recover alcoholic. Yes, so my husband and I had him for 2 days in our home. And so I didn't think about this talk not even one time. I thought about survival for me or him. You know, he's one of us. I've had to give a lot away to God, but I've got a t-shirt that says everything I ever turned over has got claw marks on it. And it does. It certainly does. This program has given me life. The life I had before wasn't life. It was death. I have a God, Almighty God, the wonderful God of my understanding, who gave me everything, everything, more than I've ever hoped to even consider to think about wanting. If I had made my list, it would have never come up to this. And they tell me, all the people that are in front of me that have more time than I do, that it gets better. That all I got to do is keep doing what I've been doing. And that it keeps getting better. This is the easier, softer way. The great gift that I have been given here is a return to life. A return to feelings. A return to love. When I came into this program, I was totally incapable of giving anything about you. I cared nothing for you. I cared nothing for me either, but I was all I had, right? I was all I had. And I was the center of the universe, and everybody else was just a little tiny planet revolving somewhere way out there. So I was totally disconnected from another human being. My life today is connected. I feel, dear God, do I feel. Sometimes I feel a great deal of pain. God continues to reveal more and more to me about me. And sometimes that is almost more than I can bear. But he also continues to reveal to me more about you. And I love you. I have come to love you so much. Somehow it's so easy to give yourself away when you speak, just to lay it out and just to give it to you as a gift, because you get so much love back. There is so much love here in this room and in our rooms. The people who get up, the speaker last night, he was just wonderful. Giving of total self. And the other little caveat is that I must give it to keep it. I was reading in his Bill Sees It yesterday, and it was talking about the two great principles of AA. Humility and responsibility. Humility and responsibility. My responsibility to be here, to stay here, to do what I'm supposed to do here. And my understanding that it is God doing all these things, that I am along for the ride if I will cooperate. And it's just like God told me this morning. You can trust me. You can trust him. He is here healing our hearts today.